On this episode of Baseball Barbiecast, we recap the Tokyo series, the Dodgers taking both games from the Cubs in Tokyo, all the highlights from those two games before we preview the American League Central, featuring the historically awful Chicago White Sox, the Minnesota Twins trying to bounce back. Can the Royals and Tigers get back to the postseason? Can the Guardians defend their crown? All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbiecast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbiecast, the only baseball podcast in the world who believes that every MLB game should start at 6 a.m. local time. I'm Jake Mintz, and that's Jordan Schusterman. And if you're not willing to rise and grind for your fandom, do you really love ball?
You say 6 a.m. local time. Obviously, that is not when the Tokyo series started. But for us, we have been up early this week watching the first two official games of the Major League Baseball season in 2025. The Dodgers sweeping the Chicago Cubs in two games in the Tokyo series on this episode of Baseball Barbiecast, which we are recording together in the same room, in the same studio with this beautiful, look, we're going to high five in the same studio here in New York City with the wonderful Baseball Barbiecast logo behind us. On this episode, we are going to review the Tokyo series between the Dodgers and the Cubs, which gave us some stuff to talk about. The games weren't particularly compelling, but we had a good time waking up at 6 a.m. for those. And then we are going to talk about the opposite of the Tokyo series, the American League Central, as we preview the teams in the Midwest, one of the worst teams in baseball history, the White Sox, and four other teams who Jake still cannot decide which one will be winning the division.
But we will begin with our opener, which is, of course, the Tokyo series, an event for the ages. The first ever Tokyo series was played 25 years ago in 2000. Okay. 25 years later, Major League Baseball returns to Japan with a slightly different level of popularity. Shohei Ohtani is the most notable baseball player on the globe. It is not close. He and the Dodgers, who have taken over Japan from a popularity standpoint, played two games against the Cubs, technically home games for the Chicago Cubs, which is hilarious because 98% of the crowd was pulling for the Dodgers. And then there was like Seiya Suzuki's uncle was there too. These games were not close or competitive. The Dodgers won both of them. They did not blow the Cubs out. They won handedly. In game one, Yoshinobu Yamamoto goes for the Dodgers against Shota Imanaga for the Cubs. Cool that both Japanese pitchers, like, that is amazing. That is notable. That is awesome.
Yeah.
Imanaga is really good. He's pulled after four innings because he walks four hitters more than he had walked last season in any game. And then Ben Brown, the reliever, coughs up three runs in the fifth inning. Ohtani, two hits, two runs. Cubs have just one base runner after an Ian Happ single in the third. Yamamoto is really good. The Dodgers bullpen is really good. They win game one. Not a whole lot there. Game two, a lot more hype for this one because it was the debut of Roki Sasaki, Japanese phenom, 24 years old, throws cheddar cheese, but is he actually good? Still TBD. He was awesome. Like, visually, it was sick. The stuff was dynamite. He was very volatile, walked five hitters in three innings, which, according to my notes, is too many. The Dodgers, however, because they are the Dodgers, they pounce on Justin Steele in the early going. Three home runs for them. Edmund, Kike, Shohei, Homer. We'll talk about that. And they win that game 6-2-3.
So I think, now the first game, I would say just the biggest takeaways from those was, or from the performances of that one, because, yeah, you know, we didn't have a ton of offense in that first game. We didn't have any home runs. Imanaga was pretty good, and I think his walks were more of indicative of a not-so-awesome strike zone versus his command, whereas Sasaki's walks were like, okay, he's kind of all over the place. Yamamoto was fantastic. That was my favorite part of game one. Remember, this is a guy who only made it through one inning in his MLB debut in Korea a year ago, and he came over with, you know, different kind of hype than Sasaki, but also there was a lot of expectation because he had signed this massive contract, whereas, you know, Sasaki's
playing for free,
playing for the minimum and is a few years younger. Yamamoto, as we know, goes on to have a pretty fantastic rookie season, but he just looks so in command. The splitter was ridiculous, and his splitter we've already talked on this pod about the difference between his splitter and Sasaki's splitter, and we can get into that a little bit more. But I just, I love watching Yamamoto pitch. He is masterful. And I think that there is so much talent on this Dodgers pitching staff, as we learned in that first game, even after Yamamoto, where I guess the bullpen was perfect, I think, outside of a Blake Treinen hit by pitch. And that's Bonda, Kasperius, Treinen, and Tanner Scott getting his first save as a Dodger. You know, the Dodgers announced their roster to open the season, and not only are they missing Mookie and Freddie, but we'll get to that, they put 10 pitchers on the injured list to start, or I guess 9 pitchers on the injured list to start the season, a continuation of last year, but not just the guys that were hurt at the end of last year, but guys that got hurt in spring training this year, right?
What a flex.
Like Kopech and Gonsolin and so many guys that they don't have available, Evan Phillips, and it didn't matter. They have these guys that they can just keep going to, and that extended into game two as well.
So let's talk about Mookie and Freddie. So we get news a couple days before game one of the series that Mookie is not there anymore, that he had flown back to America because he was ill. He lost 15 pounds, which is really a ridiculous, like, that is an unsafe, dangerous amount. I hope Mookie's doing better and feels okay. That's scary. About a half hour before first pitch, we get news that Freddie Freeman is scratched. Rib issue, similar rib issue that he was dealing with during the playoffs last year. So the Dodgers are just playing without their second and third best hitter, and it doesn't matter. However, the reason we want to bring this up again and harp on it a little bit is that when thinking about the Dodgers as an operation, as an organization, it is difficult to envision how it goes wrong. And Mookie and Freddie not being available gives us a little taste of that, and that is they are old. And when you are old, you are much more likely to just break down, miss time with random stuff, and get hurt. Now, these two things are not predictive, and I think what happened to Mookie particularly is, like, very random. Mm-hmm. Still, if the Dodgers are bad in the next 4 years, it is because their roster is older than the typical good team.
Yeah, and I do think that this is still more of a big picture concern in terms of projecting, because right now the baseball world just feels like Dodgers will never lose, and obviously there's other ways for them to acquire young talent, as we just saw with Sasaki over the next decade, but they had the oldest position player group in baseball a year ago, and that is very likely to be true again this year. And I think with Freddie especially, who was an Iron Man for so long in his career, and then obviously last year started to deal with a litany of injuries, and so it's just kind of an ominous start in that sense. I'm willing to just say the Mookie thing is more of a fluke, and that's fine. You know, yeah, Freddie's 35, and this is still the kind of thing that your team can just deal with these things more often if your entire position player group is in their 30s. Again, they're still deserved to be far and away projected the best team in baseball, and I think they're going to win 110 games. All these things are there, but it was at least particularly with the Freddie thing and how the things he kind of dealt with at the end of last year. It was just kind of a reminder that they are going to have to eventually find some new young players, and I think they probably will because they are good at that too.
Speaking of, Roky Sasaki starts game two. He, let's be very clear about this. If game two of the year was in Cincinnati or Los Angeles, this would have been Blake Snell.
Yeah.
And that's okay. Yeah. It's okay to understand why Sasaki threw. I'm happy he did. I think it was well worth it. MLB realizing that they don't need to make these exhibition games, that these games can count, and there are 162 of them, and it's okay if the Dodgers caught, like, almost following that lead and starting, being willing to start Sasaki, good. Sasaki was what we expected. 3 strikeouts, 5 walks, 1 hit over 3 innings, 56 pitches, 25 strikes. Okay. He's throwing a hundo in the first. He's throwing 95, 96 by the third.
Yeah.
The splitter is unbelievable from a movement perspective.
Yeah. He wasn't commanding it as well as he was in his spring training outing, when it really seemed like he knew exactly what he was doing with it. And yeah, he was obviously spraying the fastball. This kind of performance just, you know, had me doing all kinds of stat head searches where it's like, what is this going to look like over even, say, 100 innings, right? Where he's probably going to have one of the lowest batting average against in the league, and he's probably going to walk 9-10% of hitters, and he's probably going to strike out 27-20. It looks like Blake Snell, right? Or like some version of, like, you know, there's like some Freddie Peralta seasons that we've seen like this. Like, if you are never allowing hits, you are probably going to still be effective. It's just going to be from a workload standpoint and from a, obviously, 25 strikes in 56 pitches is just, that's just not going to be good enough to eat a bunch of innings, let alone if he's going to be able to hold up from a physical standpoint.
But
he's going to be effective because it is going to be difficult for hitters to consistently, they might be able to get to reach base by just standing there, as we saw as his outing went on. But it is going to be difficult for hitters to hit him consistently.
Well, he doesn't need to be anything other than what he was today because of who the Dodgers have on their roster.
Sure.
If he was Tarek Skubal on the Tigers and he needed to throw seven innings every day, I would not be optimistic about Sasaki's season. But if the Dodgers are just going to, they can afford to roll him out there, let him chuck it for three and a third and see how the development goes. I did not learn anything new about Roki Sasaki today. It kind of confirmed everything that we had believed about this guy. The talent, just watching this guy move down the mound is beautiful.
Yeah.
Especially in contrast to Justin Steele, who is also good, but is less aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah,
Justin Steele looks like he's falling over, and then the ball comes out of his hand. Sasaki looks like ballet.
Yeah.
Interesting start. Excited to watch him stateside. One more Dodgers thing, and then we'll briefly talk about the Cubs. Shohei Ohtani homered.
Yep, that's what it says in the box score. that's what crew chief Bill Miller's confirmed via very speedy replay.
Do we have any tinfoil hats in the studio?
So the Dodgers won this game handily. They didn't need this Shohei Ohtani home run. Shohei Ohtani probably didn't need this home run to still win MVP this year.
But we did, man.
but after Tommy Edman and Kike launched balls earlier in the game that very clearly cleared the fence, no doubt about them. Ohtani, when he tees off on this Nate Pearson 99-mile-an-hour fastball, I thought it was like, all right, well, that's going 500 feet like the other ones. But then, you know, PCA's ranging back and it hits something and it lands in play. And then Kyle Tucker kind of looks up and points and the ball's in play. And Ohtani kind of slows down at second. And then they're like, home run. And then it's like, well, that was weird. And then they review it. And it sure looks like the ball was not going to go out and that multiple fans tried to catch it, as you know, that happens all. That's unfortunately a thing that happens in baseball games. And they were like, yeah, home run. Sure. Whatever. I don't know. It seemed like it was a crew
umpire review.
Initiated review. I don't know if Craig Counsell has said anything about this all we can say is this feels like a play that a opposing manager would be a lot more irked about in other circumstances.
Yeah.
And I'm totally understand if Craig Counsell was like, whatever, we're losing and it happens. I understand. Give Ohtani the homer. That's great. It's fine. But
we're
just reacting to what we saw, which is like, as far on the, you know, continuum of like what fan interference looks like for a home run and the ball looking like it didn't go over the fence, that looked like it wasn't going to go over the fence. So that's how I feel about it.
The fan, I think, would have had to miss his incredible their arm yards into the field of play to get this overturned.
Yeah.
You're not taking a home run away from Ohtani in Japan.
Which is fine.
If it was any other player who had hit this ball and there was interference like this, it would be non-story territory. But because it's Ohtani and it's just ripe for tin foil hat wearing baseball players and conspiracy theorists.
Well, the other part about it is it's like, it's not like we don't have better camera angles. Like, there's plenty of cameras in that stadium that probably could have shown that it was not going over.
It's not like the umps are working on other games, right? Like,
so whatever. It doesn't matter. It doesn't change the fact that the Dodgers deserve to win this game. They were going to win this game anyway.
Yeah.
The Cubs did not look awesome. We had a couple good Cubs. I guess, what were the Cubs' highlights? Matt Shaw's defense looked great. His offense didn't look great, but he made his major league debut. That was great. John Birdie had three hits. Good for John Birdie. Probably not what you want to be highlighting for the Cubs offense in the beginning of the season.
Long flight home.
Yeah, long flight home. So Cubs will be fine. They have a difficult April schedule that also features the Dodgers four more times. So that'll be interesting for them, or five more times, I think.
Yeah.
So hopefully they can kind of get back on this side of the world and have a little bit more success.
I want to clap it up very briefly for the baseball community. A year ago when the Dodgers opened up in Korea against the Padres, you saw a lot of people saying, what is going on? This is a no way to grow the game. having opening day start at 5 a.m. in the middle of the night or 2 a.m. in the middle of the night Pacific time. What are we doing? Didn't see that this year as much. Good job, everyone. Yeah. Because I think it was so obvious why this is a good thing. Yep. Japan likes baseball more than we do in America. Full stop. Bringing the best version of the sport over there regularly is good for the sport.
Yep.
Full stop. I wish that the Cubs had been more competitive and that it didn't feel like they were just a foil for a Dodgers victory parade in Japan. I hope that other teams gain popularity over there, like the Dodgers.
Yeah.
And, but still, this was a rousing success. The Dodgers should open every year there. They should.
Yeah. I do wonder at what point they would be like, oh boy. Like some of the players are like, here we go again. Or they're just like, yeah, of course we open the season in Japan every year. Of course that's how it should work. I could see that going in both directions. And who's to say? Maybe I have to imagine the fact that they went through this in some form last year help them prepare for this on many fronts. But it's two games. No reason to take too much of it. They will return and we will resume a regular baseball season next week. The last thing I will say about this before we take a break is everyone should go read Jake's piece on Hideo Nomo and his impact on all of this being possible. It was a great story. I learned a lot. I think you will learn a lot too. So you should go check that out on Yahoo Sports. We are going to take a quick break. And when we return, it's time to talk about the American League Central. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Enough about Japan, all right? This is America. Let's talk about the American League Central, a division that has just one Japanese-born player. Shouts out Kenta Maeda. Kenta Maeda, who is on the Tigers and was on the Twins, is the only Japanese-born player to appear in this division since 2014.
Whoa! Who was it before?
Nori Aoki, Kansas City Royal.
Oh, Royals, of course. Yes. Aoki, I was like, Aoki, who do you play for? Yes, Kansas City. That I should have remembered that. That was I have to imagine they still quite like Nori Aoki in Kansas City. But anyway, the American League Central, not exactly a hub of Japanese superstars. Kenta Maeda, how much he will contribute in Detroit this year. Who's to say? We'll get to the Tigers later. Generally, in these division previews, we have gone in order of the projected finish according to Fangraphs, because we like Fangraphs and there's other projecting systems, but it's like, that's good. That'll lay it out for us. However, we are making an editorial decision to go in a slightly different order this time, because not that we are anti-Twins, who the Fangraphs projections have winning this division, but we kind of want to lean more into just how this division has changed and what it just gave us to talk about a year ago. So we are still going to go worst to first. We are going to start with the White Sox, but we're going to go in the order of the finish in this division. So we will start with the White Sox and the Twins, the Tigers and Royals, who finished with the same record. The Royals technically finished ahead seeding-wise, and then we will finish with the defending champion Guardians. But let's begin. We are still going to do, you know, the format will stay the same. Otherwise, we'll tell you what happened last year. We'll tell you about the over-unders. We'll tell you who's on their team, what they did in the offseason, one big question, some key players, and then we will tell you over or under. But Jake, let us begin with the Chicago White Sox.
How did it go? I didn't see the game. Missed the game. What happened?
You missed the many games where they lost. They are projected by Fangraphs to win 63 games. That's not very many, but it is way more than they won a year ago. As last year, we knew they were going to be one of the worst teams in baseball. So that part was not a shock. Their over-under was 60.5. And both of us said under. We were like, whoa, this team's going to be really bad. In fact, Jake last year on the podcast said, they're going to be a train wreck. I'll take the under on 55.5. And boy, did you nail it. Now, would you have taken the under on 45.5?
No.
Probably not. But that is what they did, as the White Sox went 41-121, folks. The most losses in baseball history. If your team is not the Cleveland Spiders of 1899, truly the worst team in baseball history. But the most losses since the turn
Since the other century turn.
Since 1900, the most losses in a season. Oh, my God. This team was so horrible.
Really bad.
And why were they so horrible? It was one of the worst offenses we've ever seen. So how do they remedy that? How do they bounce back from one of the worst teams we've ever seen?
Juan Soto.
They weren't in the mix for Juan Soto. They bring in a bunch of veterans that they will try to trade. That's Bryce Wilson. That's Martin Perez, Mike Tauchman in the outfield. Brandon Drury and Michael A. Taylor, two of the worst hitters in baseball last year, are going to come in and try and improve the worst offense in baseball. Interesting strategy. Travis Jankowski, Joey Gallo, they signed him until he decided, I want to pitch. We'll talk about that at some point if he signs as a pitcher. But I am rooting for him.
If Soto got 765 from the Mets,
yeah,
what number could the White Sox have given him where he would have been like, yeah, I'll do that? Do you think the White Sox had given him a bill, like a flat bill?
Boris would have been like, you got to consider it. I'm sorry. If I can negotiate a $1 billion contract, I'm going to do that.
If you're White Sox fans, would you have been happy with an offseason that was just Juan Soto for a bill? Is that a win? Because, again, he's probably then on the next good White Sox team.
Yeah, because it's 15, I mean, however many years. But that also might be setting them back in their rebuild, which is...
Right.
But I don't know. Anyway,
Sox fans,
question. Yeah.
Email us.
Let us know. BaseballBarbecast@gmail.com. Did you want to sign Juan Soto?
For a bill.
I don't know how you're going to answer that. Jake, who's on the Chicago White Sox?
Not Juan Soto. Behind the dish, it's Corey Lee and Matt Theis with potentially prospect Kyle Teal.
Edgar Caro, maybe?
Showing up at some point. Yep. Two of their top prospects are catchers. So keep an eye on that. First base, Andrew Vaughn. Second base, the pride of Russia, Lenin Sosa. Third base, Miguel Vargas, who Chicago got in the Eric Fetty, Michael Kopech three-way deal at the deadline last year. Shortstop is going to be me and you, buddy, just kicking it. Chase Meidroff?
Maybe. Yeah, I mean, it could be Josh Rojas, who's injured. They wanted Colson Montgomery, top prospect, to, like, go win the job. He
didn't do that.
So he's back in AAA. I don't know.
Whoever it is, they're not going to be very good. The outfield in Luis Robert Jr. in center, Mike Tauchman in right, Andrew Benintendi in left, but
he has a broken hand. So he is not going to be available. He is, of course, their highest paid player, making $17 million this year. He will not be available for the start of the season. He actually wasn't that bad last year, so he would be helping this offense if he was available, but he is not.
Michael A. Taylor might be there, maybe some Travis Jankowski in the mix, and then DH will be Brandon Drury maybe. The rotation is Martin Perez, Jonathan Cannon, Davis Martin, Sean Burke, Bryce Wilson. I'm not even going to talk about the bullpen. This team stinks. They're going to stink again. They stank last year, but my one big question is, what about this team is meaningfully better or more hopeful than the historically catastrophic 2024 version?
There are some people really confused about why you said Jonathan Cannon's name that way, but we'll give you the opportunity to explain that after I answer this one big question. What will be better about this team? Because realistically, you could look at this team and be like, wow, this roster is actually worse than what they had a year ago, where they had Garrett Crochet, who at this time a year ago, we didn't know was about to be one of the best pitchers in baseball. But they had him and Fetty. Those were huge wins before they traded him. Now you're looking at the rotation and be like, well, there's no way this rotation is going to be as good as it was with Garrett Crochet and Eric Fetty. And the offense still looks pretty horrific, even if you've added some more accomplished veterans. That said, this team was... Actually, what was their Pythagorean record last year? Because obviously their run differential was terrible, but I guess they were projected to... Okay, so by run differential, they should have won 48 games instead of 41. So
that's just
so they got you know, really unlucky team. It would be very difficult to be as bad as they were last year, obviously. Almost no matter who's on the team, truly. And because of that, I think they are still going to be the worst team in baseball. But I do think that the offense cannot be as bad again. I don't know how it's going to be better because the names do not look good. I do not think it can be that bad. It was one of the worst offenses we've ever seen in every metric. They were 30th in basically every category that wasn't steals, and they were like 26th in that. So I mean, they might be 30th again in most categories. I just think that historically, it won't be historically awful. It'll just be plain bad. And that kind of has to be the goal. And remember, they were an embarrassment for a lot of reasons last year. The offense was a big part of it. Pedro Grifol did not seem to be the right person to be leading a team that is knowingly bad. And now Will Venable knew what he was signing up for here. And so...
I hope so.
Will Venable knows he's going to finish in last place this year, but he seems like he's coming from a place in Texas where he actually has had some success. And I have to think that he is probably in a better position to guide a group that understands the assignment this year instead of being kind of delusional about what the goals are and Pedro Grifol saying, we're going to kick your ass, when they were obviously one of the worst teams we've ever seen.
For this team to be better at all, they need my key player, Luis Robert Jr., to act like Luis Robert Jr. And that's both to give fans a reason to flick on the television, because even a 60-win team with Luis Robert Jr. on it, I mean, I'll watch.
He was one of the most exciting players in baseball in 2023. You know, it was he went 38 homers, 20 steals. He's, when he's healthy and really trying, one of the best defensive center fielders in the league.
Yeah.
He is an amazing talent. Last year, he was bad like everyone else on the team.
He was bad and hurt, and I think if he's better, they'll trade him, and they should, because what's the point of having a Ferrari in a burned down house?
Yeah.
Still, he's got to be better just for the overall direction of the franchise.
Yeah, I mean, that's true in the sense that he's their last big trade chip, really. I mean, they have some of these other veterans that I'm sure they're hoping to flip if they can be decent for 2 months. But Robert is their last chance to bring in a haul similar to what they got for Crochet, where when you are in talent acquisition mode, young talent acquisition mode, he needs to be better for them to be able to do that. But for me, my key player, again, it's just who is going to step up as an offensive player that you feel like is going to be on the team in 3 years. Because even if Luis Robert's awesome, he's going to get traded. So guys like Miguel Vargas, who was supposed to be a centerpiece of this trade return, guys like Colson Montgomery, guys like Kyle Teal and Chase Mindrath, who they just got in this trade, we have to, even Lenin Sosa, who I think was good in the last couple months and is only 25, like someone that you think is just something as part of this position player group, that is what I need to see to feel like this organization is trending in the right direction. Because if we're going to give White Sox fans something to be optimistic about, it's that they have had some wins with the pitching staff. Crochet is an amazing story for so many reasons, and you have to give the White Sox some amount of credit because they were optimistic enough to give him the opening day start. They clearly believed he could be a starter. But Crochet's story is a lot about Garrett Crochet's belief and talent and something that, which again, the White Sox still deserve credit for identifying and all those things. But what they were able to do with Fetty, Sean Burke, who's there, also surprise opening day starter. I think he's going to be a good pitcher. I like Jonathan Cannon. Davis Martin has some success. They have some real guys coming on the farm. Hagen Smith, Noah Schultz. They have a lot of arm talent there. So a year from now, we could be looking at this pitching staff and being like, all right, like that's going to be kind of a pain in the ass to face to try to score against. But when the offense is this bad, it's nobody is going to take you seriously. So that is the most important thing for them.
That was far too much time given to the worst team in baseball history. But because we care about every fan base, we'll do it. Over under 53.5. This line is trying to trick you. Okay. Vegas, boo, is setting this line comically low, assuming that people will just hammer the under on the White Sox. Where are you at?
So this is the lowest line, unsurprisingly. It is good. Far lower than the Marlins. A year ago, the A's had the lowest line at 57.5. We know that they went comfortably over there. 53.5. Can this team be 13 wins better than a year ago? I'm going to say yes, barely. I think this is 54, 55. 60 would stun me. But 41 is so hard to do. But I think they'll still be the worst. I think they'll still be the worst team in baseball. And I think it'll be, maybe I will go under. Where are you at?
You go first.
I said over.
I'll go over too. Okay.
That's hard. If you want to know why Jake said Jonathan Cannon's name that way, email us baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. Let's move on to the Minnesota Twins. Is it disrespectful for us to be talking about them after talking about the Chicago White Sox?
They don't get a say in the matter, and that is because of how last year ended. They were in position to make the postseason. They were in the hunt for the division.
In August.
And then the bottom fell out in true coffin flop fashion, and they finished the year 83-79.
No.
Excuse me, that's last year. 82-80.
82-80, It was a miserable 82-80. They lost 18 of their final 25 games. Their over-under last year was 86.5, and you slammed the over. They were one of your favorite teams in the American League going into the season. You were like, oh, Royals and Tigers off seasons, don't buy it. I also took the over. I was like, I was skeptical, but I was like, they got a lot of good players. I think they'll win the division. They didn't do that, obviously. They end up finishing fourth. And then, you know, after you have a season like that, you're like, well, we got to do something about this, right?
No.
No.
Someone's got to do something about this.
For whatever reason, there is some uncertainty with the ownership. They're trying to sell. They thought they were going to sell the team to an Ishbia brother. And he was like, just kidding, not doing that. Going to go buy more of the White Sox. Make of that what you will.
Sure.
So instead, they did very little. They signed Harrison Bader, Ty France, Danny Coulomb, all to one-year deals. And I guess they're running it back with a very similar team. They lost a couple key pieces, but once again, they will pray to the health gods who have already frowned down upon them as Royce Lewis is already injured. Jake, who is on this Minnesota Twins team that is projected by Fangraphs to win this division with a modest 83 wins?
That's so funny. Winning a division with 83 wins is so great.
That's the AL Central before last year.
Behind the dish will be Ryan Jeffers and Christian Vasquez. Ty France. The Tide de France is back. He's going to be playing first base. Infield alignment is a little up in the air because of Royce Lewis's injury. I'm just going to go with Willy Castro, all-star at second base, utility guy. Shortstop, Carlos Correa. Third base, Brooks Lee. With an outfield of Matt Wallner in right, Byron Buxton in center, and Trevor Larnach in left with Jose Miranda DHing. Rotation is Pablo Lopez, Joe Ryan, Bailey Ober, Simeon Woods Richardson, and Chris Paddock, and a bullpen of Air Force icon without Griffin Jacks. There's no Paul Skeens.
That's not true. Just know that, folks.
And Joan Duran, who rules. I am really confused about this team. I was so high on them last year. There was no club I was more incorrect about. I am embarrassed. I am full of shame as a result. And so I don't know what to do with my hands here, because the big question about this team, as it has been for many years, do their good players play baseball? Are they healthy enough to play baseball? Carlos Correa, Byron Buxton, and Royce Lewis, a triad of soft tissue injuries and trips to the injured list. How many games total do they appear in?
So I agree. I think that's the big question. I think Twins fans would say the same. This is year four of the Correa-Buxton duo, which understandably had once the Twins got Carlos Correa, which was a shock in and of itself at the time, and he's, of course, committed there and really become kind of the face of that team. What's also interesting is their performance levels have fluctuated, right? You want to say, oh, well, if they're on the field, they'll all be awesome. Well, Correa was not awesome Correa and Buxton were not awesome when they played in 23, which is funny because that has been their most successful season. Royce Lewis was healthy for the last 2 months last season and was bad. And he has less of a track record of Carlos Correa and Byron Buxton to lean on, whereas Buxton and Correa, even though they've, of course, been hurt, for the most part, when they play, they are awesome. And that was true last year for sure. Lewis, it's less of a track record. Of course, this amazing start to his career and all these grand slams, and he's very likable, and we were rooting for Royce Lewis. But it was a pretty big sample of poor play last year when he was healthy. Now he's hurt again, so now we have another slow start to the season. But the problem is, like, those are your stars. That's what you're banking on, and so there's not enough else around them to where we can be too optimistic if they aren't going to get impact play from the certainly Buxton and Correa. But Lewis, I think you have to love him in there as well.
If you lower the plate appearance threshold for last season, Carlos Correa, right up there.
Awesome. Like, he was awesome again. And he was still playing through the same foot issue that he was dealing with the year before. But when he was on the field, man, he's pretty much delivered what they brought him there to do.
Turn the knob down to 350 plate appearances. Judge?
That's the Twins filter. That's literally
the Twins filter.
That is the Twins filter.
Turn on the Twins filter, 350 plate appearances. Judge, Otani, Soto, Yordan, Bobby Witt, Vlad Jr., Rooker, Correa, Gunnar Henderson.
It's also the Twins fielder because it also applies to Matt Wallner with his just, with his platoon.
It's great.
I mean, Correa was fantastic, and Buxton. Remember, they did this weird thing where they were like, "All right,
UDH now."
That was 2023. That did not go well.
No,
he still didn't stay healthy, and he wasn't good when he was hitting. So they're like, "Screw it, whatever. Just go back out to center." And he's like, "Fine, awesome. Now I'm center. I can play center." He plays 94 games in center last year, and he's fantastic. Still misses, 60 games, but he was good when he was playing. So this team is just so perplexing. It is so frustrating when you have talent of that caliber, but maybe it is more about the rest of the supporting cast, stepping up and become, because we've seen bits and pieces. We've seen Wallner kind of look like an impact player. We thought Julian was kind of trending that way. Miranda was quietly very good. Willie Castro has this awesome super utility season, but can he repeat it? Jeffers has been an above average offensive catcher. So there are pieces here. That's why they're still projected to be a solid team. But I don't know. Who are some other key players that you want to talk about? Because we haven't talked about the pitchers really much.
Pablo Lopez, who was an absolute dog in 2023, finishes 7 in the Cy Young behind a new pitch that he added that year, which was a sweeper. Lopez, one of the most intelligent, interesting human beings in our sport. Last year, he was fine, aggressively okay. Nothing quite obvious backed up for him. The sweeper that he had added in 23 was a little bit worse in 24, and he was more of a solid mid-rotation type than the ace he's supposed to be there. And it's in there. It's possible. And I think that if he can come out and get down ballot Cy Young votes this year, it means that Correa and Buxton and Lewis can afford another 15 games of being injured. Right.
Yeah. Well, it just gives them more margin for error.
It gives them more margin for error. And I think that it is an area for this team that they can improve on. If you look at the roster, you're like, how does this roster get better than last year? Who's producing at a higher clip? To me, it's Lopez.
Yeah. I think Lopez is a good pick. I think Joe Ryan, his numbers for the first 2.5 months last year, he is an elite strike thrower at the very least. And sometimes that means he allows a bunch of home runs. But for the most part, he is a very strong, and he also finished the year injured. So that's another thing to watch. I'm going to highlight Brooks Lee here as a position player I'm very intrigued about. A year ago, this was a guy who was a top 30 prospect in baseball. He did make his major league debut. It did not go super great. He didn't get a ton of playing time. I believe he, almost 200 plate appearances, but an OPS under 600. He is someone now, especially with Lewis already hurt again, he's going to have to be in that everyday lineup, either at second, either at third. This is a guy who, talent-wise, should be an impact player. The first start, first kind of go with the big leagues was not great for him, but he can be a difference maker really on both sides of the ball, and I have to imagine that they are really counting on him to elevate his game to at least be an average player, because last year he was not contributing in the way I have to imagine they had hoped, because that was also part of why they weren't able to hang on, is because they just didn't have enough supporting hitters around the guys that we are really expecting from them. The over-under for the Twins is 83.5. As we mentioned, the projected record is 83 wins, even if that is enough to win the division. They won the division with 87 wins in 2023. 83.5. Oh, man, by the way, spoiler alert, this is the same line for the next three teams.
I don't know.
Or within one game. You go first this time.
Over.
I am going to go over. Oh, am I going to go over? Yeah, I'll go over. I'm not. I think they're going to be right in the middle. I think they're going to finish third. I don't think they're going to finish fourth, but I think that is going to be over 83.5. So that's where I'm at with Minnesota.
Here's my take on the Twins. Buxton and Correa can't get hurt again, can they? There's no way, right? That seems impossible. It's got to go better this year. So for that reason, I'm high on the Twins. Right. I'm taking the over.
All right. We'll see how that goes. One more team before we take a break. Let's talk about the Detroit Tigers, who are projected to win 82 games by Fangraphs. A year ago, their over-under was 81.5. There was some optimism. We compared them and the Royals a lot, but the Tigers in 2023 were not an embarrassment. They were trending in the right direction. They were not a good team yet.
They were cute,
but it was like 81.5 reflects like another step forward. We both took the under. I said on the podcast a year ago, I said I thought 2024 was going to be the year before the year. And I was like, I don't think they're a playoff team, but I think that, after the 2024 season, we're going to be feeling really good about the Tigers. So I might have been right about that if the Tigers now like go on and win the division and now it's like, okay, now they're here, they've arrived. But there's also a version of this team where it was like, ooh, they might have been early and this might be a year where they take a step back. We both said under, they went over, they win 86 games.
Tigers won again.
Tigers won again. GMAC Cash let us know. And they were a ton of fun. I mean, obviously one of the best teams in baseball in the second half, even after trading away Jack Flaherty. I covered that series against the Guardians that went five games. It was a hell of a series. It was really cool watching the Tigers up close. We know they go down to Houston. They are the team that vanquishes and ends the Astros ALCS streak. Tarek Skubal wins the Cy Young. A lot goes right for the Tigers. And at the end of the season, you look at their total numbers and you're like, how did they do this with Riley Green and Skubal and not a ton else? Let's get into this team. They had a kind of a weird offseason. Some short-term deals. Some of them look good. Some of them not so much. They bring back Jack Flaherty because nobody wanted to sign him. They sign Alex Cobb. He immediately gets hurt. Surprise, surprise. They sign Gleyber Torres. I like that move. Tommy Canley comes in as veteran bullpen reinforcement, which brings us to this roster. Jake, who is on the Tigers?
Feels like everybody can just kind of play everywhere. So it is...
For better or for worse.
For better or for worse. Behind the dish, Jake Rogers and Dylan Dingler. One of the best ball names we've got. Dylan freaking Dingler. First base, Colt Keith. We'll definitely see some Spencer Torkelson over there still, but Keith is projected to be the opening day guy. Gleyber Torres and his enormous beard that he could have kept if he had stayed in New York will be at second base. Third base.
That's true, because it is well-groomed.
Oh, it's very well-groomed.
It's very well-groomed.
Very well-groomed.
So that's,
third base,
that's a good point.
Zach McKinstry, Andy Ibañez, maybe some Matt Vierling when he gets back from the IL. Maybe some Jace Young if he plays well in AAA. Maybe some Javier Baez if that happens. Shortstop, they're going to roll with Trey Sweeney. Javi Baez is on this roster. He has three more seasons under his current contract with the Tigers. He has been abysmal as a member of this team. They are not going to give him free at-bats anymore. However, they do believe that he can be helpful on the roster. He will play.
And they're not eating the money.
And they're not.
They don't want to just eat the, what is it, $70 million he's still owed.
Yeah.
So he's going to be on, now that he's healthy, he finished the year with, on the IL, I think, hip surgery. But he's back. He's been playing this spring. And he is owed $75 million over the next 3 years. So this ownership group is not just going to say, sorry, like, take a hike. Like, we'll find a way to make you a utility player.
He's still only 32. A Javi Baez renaissance, oh my God, that would fill me up with so much joy, but I am not counting on it. Neither should Tigers fans. The outfield, though, I would count on that. In left field, Riley Green. In right field, Kerry Bonds, Kerry Carpenter, one of my favorite players in the game. Center is going to be Parker Meadows when he gets back from the IL. He's projected to return a little bit quicker than Vierling is, I think. Wensiel Perez will get some time in center. And then Torque will get most of the DH at-bats to start, I think. The rotation, though, this is the interesting part. Skubal, Tarek Skubal, reigning Cy Young winner in the American League. He's going to go on opening day, and whenever he freaking can. By the end of last season, it was Skubal and pitching chaos. They did go out and sign Jack Flaherty to join that group. Casey Mize will be in the mix as well. Kenta Maeda, who I mentioned before. Reese Olson. And then Jackson Jobe, who is a top three pitching prospect in baseball, is going to get some run in the rotation this year at some point. And then the bullpen, it's the cast of characters who stole your hearts and
confused you
in October. Jason Foley, Bo Brisky, Tyler Holton, Will Vest,
Tyler Holton,
Brand Herder.
And Will Vest was unbelievable. Holton was the one who did it over the whole season. Vest is the one who was just insanely good in October. And Foley was like the Capitals' E closer for most of the year, and then they kind of moved away from him at the end of the year. He barely pitched. I think he didn't pitch in the series against Cleveland, even in a five-game set, which is kind of wild. They bring in Tommy Canley to kind of bolster that group. And John Brebbia. Forgot about him. So our big question about these Tigers, I think it does have to be about the additions, because when you have a season like that, it does feel like a now we go moment. It's time to spend. We know they were in the mix to sign Alex Bregman. Like, they were making a real effort to sign Alex Bregman. That communicates that they were trying to do something more than they ultimately were able to accomplish. That seemed to be a very singular pursuit. It doesn't seem like they were opening up the wallet for any of the other top free agents. Jack Flaherty kind of falls back in their lap. Gleyber Torres is like, I have multi-year offers, but I want to go prove myself in Detroit. The Alex Cobb one, I just cannot wrap my mind around. He was so injured last year and now is immediately, I think he's back and throwing bullpen.
They gave him just $15
million? $15 million before any of the other pitchers signed. I want to be wrong. I actually grew to really appreciate Alex Cobb as like the person listening to him talk when he was like with the Guardians
hey,
last year.
Get your money, dude.
Yeah, I'm awesome for Alex Cobb. I can't wrap my mind around that being plan A. But part of that is then, okay, well, maybe there is part of this rotation that doesn't need Alex Cobb, which also makes it weirder that they gave him $15 million. But it is about how those free agents do. Can Gleyber Torres elevate this lineup? Can Tommy Kahnle, he was pretty good for the Yankees last year. Can he help a bullpen that might regress a little bit after last year? And then Cobb and Flaherty are kind of wild cards in different ways.
No team in MLB's poverty division, aka the Centrals, spent more money or committed more money, rather, than the Tigers did this winter. They committed $76 million to six different free agents. That is more than anyone else in this division. Cleveland was number two, $53 million. And so you look at that level of aggression, and there needs to be some sort of payoff there.
Yeah.
It's that simple. Because if there's not, you look back and you're like, why didn't you up the offer for Bregman?
Sure.
Right? And then you're looking at the Baez contract and you're like, man, if they hadn't given that out, you could... This organization seems like it's willing to spend a little bit of money. Did they get these right?
Yep.
And that is a huge deal this season. My key player, though, is Kerry Carpenter. Kerry Bonds. He bangs, dude. He bangs. He has some of the most fascinating splits in the sport. He is a left-handed hitter. He demolishes right-handed pitching.
By fascinating, you mean extreme to the extreme. He is one of the best hitters in baseball against right-handed pitching. He has not been given many opportunities to hit left-handed pitching, but when he has, it has not gone particularly well. He is also not bringing a whole lot on the defensive side of things, although it does seem like they're comfortable playing him fairly regularly and right.
Last year, his WRC plus with 100 being average against lefties was 18.
How many plate appearances is that?
That is in 32 plate appearances.
Okay, so they really didn't let him play against lefties.
In 264 plate appearances in the regular season against righties, 176 WRC plus. He is a top 10 hitter in the world if the pitcher throws with their right hand.
Yeah.
I am fascinated. One, does that continue? Mm-hmm. Two, can he at all figure out how to hit lefties? At all?
Will he get the chance? I don't think so. I think that like the Tigers and how they operate right now are still in the business of playing the matchups. They just have not assembled, which is part of the problem and part of why I'm hesitant to pick them to make the postseason this year is, you know, Riley Green. And I'm in on Gleyber. Like, I think Gleyber's going to be good. I think he is an everyday player. I think even if he's a 110, you know, OPS plus guy, like, that will help this team a ton. They just don't have that many other players where I'm like, yes, he should be in the lineup every day and you don't have to think about it. That is where they lack. That is the flaw with this roster. The pitching might be good enough for it not to matter. That certainly proved to be true last year. We probably could have a much longer conversation about how good Derek Skubal is, which some people could just say he is the best pitcher in the world. You can say that with a straight face, and I can say you might be right. But I'm going to go with Tyler Holton as my key player just because he bailed them out of so many different situations last year. The ultimate Swiss Army knife for A.J. Hinch, and he was starting, he was relieving, he was closing, he was going multiple innings. He was amazing last year. Can he repeat that? He really ran out of gas at the end and was not good against Cleveland. I think he's a good pitcher, but him plus all these other guys, if that's plan A, I'm a little bit concerned. We'll have a similar conversation about Cleveland to some degree because of how good their bullpen was, But that's kind of where I'm at, is are you going to get those same performances from those pitchers? Because right now, I don't see the offense as being that much better. And so I think they're going to need those arms to really step up. But maybe that's more about, you know, Mize and Olsen and if Jobe can really break through, which might happen.
Over-under is 83.5.
Yes, that's the same number as the Twins. I am going to go over. I'm still trying. I guess I'm past the deadline, so I can't remember if I ended up picking the Tigers to make the postseason or not. But I think that they're going to finish second. I think they're going to finish second. I'm in on them a little bit more than Kansas City. I trust the operation. Maybe I'm drinking the Kool-Aid because I was around them a lot last year at the end. But I think they'll find a way. But I'm a little worried about this offense.
I will also take the over. I believe in the infrastructure. I believe in Skubal. I believe in Hinch as a magic manager.
Yep.
I believe in Kerry Bonds. Yep. I believe that one of the other pitchers will become a good starter and suck up more impact innings.
Yep.
And I think they have enough mixing and matching pieces that they will have a successful enough season.
Yeah.
All right. Over on all three teams so far.
We'll see if that continues. We are going to take a quick break. When we return, we will talk about Kansas City and Cleveland. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Before we talk about the Royals and Guardians, allow me to let you know about Yahoo Fantasy Baseball. Make sure you get in one of these Yahoo Fantasy leagues. Plenty of public leagues available. Start drafting instantly today. You can sign up in the Yahoo Fantasy app or head to yahoo.com/fantasy baseball. Jake, it's time to talk about the Kansas City Royals. We lumped them together with the Tigers in a lot of ways going into last season. But it is important to recall that the Royals were coming off a much worse season in 2023. They lost 106 games, I want to say, or more than 100 games in 2023, which meant that their over-under a year ago was 73.5. It was very low. You took the under, saying you had very little faith in the position player group. There was no depth. You weren't totally wrong. However, they went way over, which is what I picked. I said, I don't think they'll actually be good, but 73.5 is a very low number. They go way over. They win 86 games, just like the Tigers. They get into the postseason. They beat the Orioles. Sad Orioles.
Orioles also beat themselves. They helped.
Orioles also beat themselves.
The Orioles helped the Royals beat the Orioles.
They sure did. Now they are projected for 81-81. 43% chance to make playoffs, 25% to win the division. What do they do over the offseason? They extended Michael Wacha before he had free agency. They traded Brady Singer for Jonathan India, one of the more interesting deals of the winter. They bring back Michael Lorenzen, and they sign Carlos Estevez to be their closer, which brings us to their roster. Who is on the Kansas City Royals, Jake?
Behind the dish, Salvador Perez, one of two official captains in Major League Baseball, and the only one who wears the C on his chest. He'll be backed up by Freddie Fermin, who is about as good of a backup catcher there is in the sport right now. Kind of a unique look, unique player, but productive. Yep. He DHs a little bit as well. First base, friend of the program, Vinny Pasquantino. Need a big year here from the Sasquatch. Second base, Michael Massey, who took a big step forward in 2024 and was a league average player. That is a big deal for a team that needs league average players around the following man. Bobby Witt Jr. put it all freaking together, man. Finishing second in the AL MVP race to Aaron Judge. He would have won the MVP in 75-85% of seasons. But what Judge did was impossible to ignore. Witt is one of the best players in the world. He will be one of the best players in the world for the foreseeable future. Little injury scare recently in spring training where he got hit on the forearm. Seems like he's going to be okay. Heck yeah, Bobby Witt forever. Third base, Michael Garcia, who was awesome in the postseason, kind of upped his game in October. MJ Melendez in left, Kyle Isbell in center, Hunter Renfro still there playing right field for the Royals. Jonathan India, who they acquired over the offseason, he's going to DH. The rotation, man, it was good. Cole Reagans as the one, Seth Lugo the two, Michael Wacha the three, Michael Lorenzen the four, and then the five spot, couple different dudes in the mix, but I'm excited about Chris Bubich, who missed all of last year with TJ. Looked unbelievable in spring training before he blew out. Bullpen is better, should be better. a full year of Lucas Ercig, who they traded for at the deadline from the Athletics, Hunter Harvey, who they traded for from the Nats, and then Carlos Estevez, who was with the Phillies and the Angels last couple of years. He'll be the closer. But the one big question with the Royals, can the supporting cast around Bobby Witt Jr. be better?
Yeah, I mean, this was a... We kind of talked about some stars and scrubs teams here, but this was about as lopsided of a position player group as you can really have. They still got another amazing year from Salvador Perez, one of my favorite players in the league. Being around him towards the end of last season when they came to Cleveland and just played 158 games. He's going into his age 35 season. You can't take that for granted. I think Salvi can still be a good player, but that's the profile that could fall off a cliff for many reasons. And so we just need some of the younger players to step up. That does mean a better, more consistent season from Vinny. I think even Vinny will tell you, as he's told me and has said publicly, like, even with the injury issues he dealt with last year, he should have been better than he was. I think he holds himself to a high standard. So I feel good about Vinny, but every other hitter besides Massey, who was more of a part-time player, was below average. And that was very clearly exposed in the postseason to a pretty difficult degree. I mean, even against Baltimore, right? Yeah. It's not like they were scoring a bunch of runs against the Orioles and then against the Yankees. It was just overmatched. And the reality is, I mean, we can just jump to Jonathan India as my key player. That was their big move, was Jonathan India. They are really counting on this guy who has been, you know, obviously a rookie of the year. So you think of him as a star level player. You know, more recently it's been he's solid. He's pretty good. You know, he's going to get on base. Is the power going to translate going from Cincinnati to Kansas City? That's something I would be concerned about. And then the fact that he doesn't have a real defensive fit here, which puts even more pressure. If he's going to be the DH, instead of maybe, you know, is he going to get some time in left? Is he going to get some time in second? I'm sure he's not going to only DH. But if you view him as a DH, like, he better hit. If you're going to designate him to hit, he better hit. And for this lineup, I mean, again, maybe Bobby Witt is an annual 10-win player. That's possible. He might be the best player in the world. But it's just asking so much from him to carry this offense. And he did it. He was good enough to get them to 86 wins because there just wasn't a lot of other help left. At the same time, man, the other thing is just, this was one of the best rotations in baseball last year. And the talent is still mostly in place, but some of those numbers, it's kind of difficult to imagine them replicating to the same degree. I think it's a top 10 rotation for sure. Is it a top 3 rotation as it was by some measures last year? That could be the difference because, remember, it's not like they got into the postseason by 10 games. You know, it was close at the end there, them and Detroit. It did take some heroic efforts to really sneak in. So I think the pitching regression is another thing, but it's still about this lineup once you get past those first few hitters.
You can't look at the team from last year, copy and paste it to this season, and believe they can do that again. I think the way that the Tigers finished their year made their run feel like more smoke and mirrors than Kansas City's. But I think Kansas City's feels more improbable when you look back at the full season stats, because beyond Bobby Witt Jr., there was really nothing of impact. I understand Salvi. Yeah,
Salvi was amazing.
Salvi's great. I mean, Salvi's great. But when you look, okay, so if you're willing to believe what I just said, then you need to do what we did with the Twins, which is like, okay, what gets better? Yeah. What is trending up for the Royals in 2025? And I think the answer to that question could be MJ Melendez. He is somebody who has always hit the ball extremely hard. He is someone with special bat speed. He stinks at hitting the ball at an optimal launch angle, strikes out a lot, and he plays crummy defense in an outfield corner, even though he's got a laser beam. If he can just be a league average hitter, dude, if he could be a league average hitter, that would be huge for this lineup. Huge. And I think of all of these players, he's the one right now I think could do that.
I mean, I want to agree, but he has now played, we're over 1,500 plate appearances for him, and he's gotten worse. So I agree. I see the physical skills, and I think that the ceiling is, I guess, there higher than maybe any of these other young hitters. And this is the other problem with them is, like, it's not a good farm system. you have this looming potential X factor of Jack Caglione, their first round pick from last year, who looked amazing in spring training. Maybe he could be an impact bat, but that's also a guy that might have to be adjusting to pro level pitching over a larger sample in the minors, and he's not going to be totally ready this year. I want to believe Melendez. To me, it's maybe more about Garcia, who now has two seasons instead of three full seasons. He also trended in the wrong direction last year. You know you're at least getting awesome defense and awesome base running from him, base running in particular. He was arguably the best non-Otani base runner in baseball last year. He stole 37 bases and was only caught twice. That's one of the things that Bobby Witt Jr., if he is going to improve his game, he needs to become a better base dealer because he was not efficient at all. But otherwise, yeah, I'm with you, like Melendez. But it's just when you're at three full seasons of not getting better and not making these changes, it's harder to believe in it. But yeah, the ceiling, I think, is definitely still there for him to be better than he has been. So, but the pitching for me, it's just I just worry that if Bobby Witt was an 8-win player and the rotation was the 10th best rotation last year, I just don't think they're in the playoffs. And I worry that that might be what we're heading towards this year. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Bobby Witt Jr. gets even better and he's putting up 12 wins and he wins the MVP. And he's obviously the best player in baseball. That still might not be enough if the rest of the supporting cast is not very good. And that's why their over-under is 82.5. But I'm more worried about them than Detroit. I think Detroit has more depth on both sides of the ball. But I think if the Royals are good again, I won't be shocked. I just have more concerns there, which is why I am going to go slight under on 82.5 for Kansas City. I just think they're more likely to go under than Detroit. But I could see both of them falling to fourth. And I'm just like Twins third. I don't know who's second. I don't know who's fourth. Obviously, I'm going to end up picking Cleveland. We'll talk about them in a second. Where are you at? 82.5 for Kansas City.
Yeah, I'll take the under. I just don't think it can go that right again. I think Bobby Witt Jr. played 161 games. That's awesome. He was a 9.5 win player. I mean, dude, he's so good.
Like, I think he will have another 10-win season again at some point.
Dudes maybe. Don't do that. It doesn't happen in consecutive years.
Yeah.
Often. So. It is very difficult to be a 10-win player 2 years in a row. And so I think it is both a bummer but rational to take the under on that for him. I think the same is true for Cole Reagans on the pitching side.
Sure.
And for me, it's really kind of that simple. I just don't see them making that up anywhere else on the roster. Yeah. So under for me, you.
I'd be going more under on Lugo than Reagans.
Okay.
And I like Lugo, but I just feel like that run prevention might not be quite as good. All right, one more team. It's the Guardians of Cleveland. They are projected by Fangraphs to finish fourth. Ooh, 78 wins. That's not a lot of wins. 22% to make the playoffs, 11% to win the division. What happened last year? Last year, their over-under was 79.5, coming off a very disappointing 2023, Terry Francona's final season. They hire Stephen Vogt, and they have mostly the same team. 79.5 a year ago, we both took the over. It was funny. You were like, rotation's going to be awesome, but they're probably not going to make the playoffs. I said, don't feel great about them making the playoffs, but they will be relevant very deep into the season. We both took the over. They went way over, winning 92 games and the division and reaching the ALCS, where they fell at the hands of Juan Soto, who used to play for the Yankees.
What?
That game three, though, one of the greatest wins of all time. John Kenzie Noel, big Christmas, one of the great moments in franchise history. But they lose to the Yankees in five games, and then they had one of the more interesting offseasons of any team in baseball. They traded away the right side of their infield that had been anchoring that position player group with Jose Ramirez for the last few years. Josh Naylor sent to Arizona. Andrés Giménez and his very long contract extension sent to Toronto. They bring back Shane Bieber, which people did not necessarily expect them to do. He had bigger offers elsewhere. He wanted to continue his Tommy John rehab with Cleveland and come back to the team that drafted and developed him. They acquire right-hander Luis Ortiz from Pittsburgh in a very convoluted series of trades. They get Slade Ciccone from Arizona in that Josh Naylor deal. They sign some veteran pitchers, Paul Sewald, to bolster the bullpen. John Means, who is still rehabbing from his second Tommy John, he probably will not be a factor this year, but they sign him and Jake Junis, who probably will be a real factor for this pitching staff in some form this season. Jake, who is on the Cleveland Guardians?
This rotation was not good last year.
Awful. Terrible. They were patching it.
Horrible.
It was Tanner Bibee and a prayer.
And Ben Lively.
So Ben Lively covered a whole bunch of innings.
Yeah. Tanner Bibee, 173 innings, ERA under 3.5.
Good pitcher.
Good pitcher.
Like Tanner Bach.
Carrasco, Logan Allen, Gavin Williams, and Tristan McKenzie all finished the year over 75 innings and were all negative win players.
Terrible, terrible.
Didn't matter.
A lot of bad innings.
Didn't matter. And that's because behind the plate, they have Austin Hedges holding your hand, guiding you through life. Austin, I could use some help too.
He's back.
Bo Naylor is the other catcher.
He's the catcher.
He's the catcher. I would like for Bo Naylor to be better than he is. If he is this good, it's fine. But I think there's more in there. First base, the return of franchise icon Carlos Santana, one of the best vets still doing it. He's 39.
Yep.
And he just won his first gold glove at first base.
Awesome. He's about to turn 39 on the day of the home opener in Cleveland. How fitting. Carlos Santana, who turned down an outrageous offer from the Seattle Mariners, who were willing to guarantee him 2 years because he loved Cleveland so much and wanted to come back for his third stint with the organization. He will be the first baseman replacing Josh Naylor.
38.2 career WAR for Santana.
Hitter. He's going to get to 400 career doubles this year.
One of the greatest Dominican players of all time.
Yeah, he's awesome. Love Carlos.
Second base, less awesome. It'll be a rotation of Tyler Freeman, Gabriel Arias, and Daniel Schneeman. If that doesn't get you excited for the season, then I don't know what does. Third base, Jose Ramirez. Enough said. Shortstop, Brian Rocchio, who the team is high on and my friend Jordan is low on. The outfield is Will Brennan and Jonkenzie Noel. Platooning in right, Lane Thomas in center, I think Stephen Kwan in left. DH will be Kyle Manzardo in the rotation, which should be better. Tanner Bibee, Gavin Williams, Ben Lively, Luis Ortiz, and Tristan McKenzie.
I don't think it's going to be Tristan McKenzie at this point. I mean, I could be wrong, but it is not going great there. I don't know if it's going to be Junis. Obviously, they're hoping it will be Shane Bieber at some point in the middle of the season. I wouldn't expect him back before July. So that fifth start spot we'll see.
And then the rotation of relievers is Emmanuel Clase, Cade Smith, Hunter Gaddis. I mean, this group was awesome.
This was the best bullpen baseball by far.
Not even
close. Like
good.
One of the best relief or bullpen seasons we've ever seen. And part of why they got away with having such a ramshackle rotation. What is the one big question for this Cleveland Guardians team? For me, it is how do they replace Andrés Giménez and Josh Naylor. We talked about Carlos Santana. We talked about that weird group of young, unproven second basemen. This was a very intentional decision in the same vein of the ones we've seen the Brewers make, trading away players a year away from free agency or who are owed a lot of money. But Josh Naylor was such an important part of this lineup. The second most important, I mean, you know, him and Kwan, but an all-star level hitter that was so important, driving in so many runs for this lineup. And then Giménez, who has certainly disappointed offensively the last 2 years, but as maybe the best infielder on the planet, is just a guaranteed 3 or 4 WAR that they are now going to try and make up with completely unproven players. Certainly, it was money motivated to move on from both of those guys, but that is quite a decision to make for a team that relied heavily on both of them that just went to the ALCS. So how they end up replacing how those guys, which includes Santana, can he continue to stave off the aging curve and continue to be productive, not just defensively where he's now this awesome first baseman, but he was still an average hitter last year, above average hitter last year. He 23 homers, still walking a bunch and not striking out a bunch. Like if you get Carlos Santana from last year again, that's great. It's a different version of a first base, you know, productive hitter than Naylor, but it's just, It's a gamble. It's a gamble. It's a money move that they're making.
No.
It's not just that.
The words money move implies
that's true.
A bit like making money moves. Like they're not making money moves.
It's a different category of money move.
It's a financially incentivized decision to cut spending. That is not, I guess it is a money move.
By the way, can we just also mention that they managed to And the Giménez one is its own separate thing. But that they managed to unload in separate trades Andrés Giménez and the $100 million he is still owed and Miles Straw to the Blue Jays.
Yeah.
Predatory.
Nailed him.
But nice, really nice.
Good bit of business.
Good bit of business. Anyway, that is my big question for them.
Key players. I'm going to go with Shane Bieber.
Oh, okay.
I was going to go with Lane Thomas, but I'm going to go with Shane Bieber.
I'll talk about Lane Thomas, so go ahead.
Shane Bieber, no timetable right now for the return. Yeah. He talked yesterday, and all the aggregated articles are like, Shane Bieber provides update on return to the mound.
The opposite of that.
And then the update is, I don't have an update.
Thanks, bro.
But that's not his, like, he...
No. He's taking his time. It was full Tommy John. He got it in April of last year, so...
And I would say, non-update is an update, because there's no... Like,
he also
know.
Just had a baby, like, 3 days ago.
Clap it up. We love that.
So, congrats to Shane. And I believe that is his first child. So that's
Cara
cool.
Bieber, I think, yes. Is his wife.
Cara?
Email us. Let us know.
You're not Shane busy with fatherhood, early days of fatherhood and rehabbing Tommy John.
Shane Bieber's new child. Email us. BaseballBarberCast@gmail.com. He looked so good before he went down last year.
Oh, my God.
So good. He looked rejuvenated. He was throwing harder. And then he blew out. If he comes back and looks like the Shane Bieber he showcased in spring, he'll be the best pitcher on the team.
Yep.
And give them a dog at the top of the rotation. I have so much faith in this organization's ability to run the bases and
play defense
and find outs. But the rotation, it's like, the lineup is, it's like, where are they scoring runs? This lineup was bad last year when they were 3 wins from the World Series.
Yeah. So is that a good thing or a bad
thing? And
then
they were like, let's get rid of our first baseman and our second baseman now. Two of our best hitters.
So it's a big bet on, I think, Lane Thomas. Remember, they got him at the deadline last year. Trusting him to be the everyday center fielder and provide above average offense, that's a lot to ask. It's a lot to ask of Santana. You're hoping to use those young hitters, Manzardo, Bo Naylor, Noel, right? I mean, John Kenzie certainly introduced himself last year. And at his first month or so in the big leagues, it was like, boom, here we got this power bat. He was terrible for September and even the beginning of the postseason before his memorable swing. So they just need some of those guys to make a difference. I think a full year of healthy Kwan will help mitigate some of that. And then the other problem is, I mean, they have a lot of depth in AAA, but like Chase DeLauder, their top offensive prospect, can't stay on the field.
He should be on the Twins.
He is Twins level injured all the time, which is frustrating. So I don't know how much he's going to be able to contribute, as he's already injured and going to be out for most of the season. Does Travis Bezzana hit his way to the big leagues? Are they saving second base for Travis Bezzana? It kind of looks like it. I don't know if that means he's going to be there this year, but that sure looked like what they were kind of hoping for. So I don't really know there. And then on the mound, I'm really interested in Gavin Williams. This is a guy who, as a rookie in 23, looked like kind of that next great frontline Cleveland starter. And injuries and underperformance last year made that not possible, to where he was not really relevant down the stretch. He has looked fantastic this spring. He throws really hard. He has great stuff. I've loved him as a pitching prospect since he was at ECU. And it's there. I think the upside is there for him. He's had trouble staying healthy as well. But if he can really hold it down in the middle of that rotation as that two or that three, if Ortiz can continue what he did in the second half for Pittsburgh, if they can stay up there until Bieber gets back, I think even if the bullpen regresses some to me being merely very good as opposed to by far the best in baseball, I think they should still be in pretty good shape. And that's why I am picking them to win the division. I think it's going to be less than 92 wins that they did a year ago. I think it'll be closer to 88 to 90, because I think this division will remain very competitive. But I think that they have enough answers and the infrastructure is there for them to defend their title. But it's tough. Obviously, Fangraphs and the projections are not as optimistic about Cleveland, and I understand that in some respects. But I'll be watching it up close. Obviously, I'll be at the Guards games all the time as an Ohio resident. So looking forward to another season with the Guards.
Over under 82.5.
I said over. I'm picking them to win the division.
I will also take the over. Jordan?
But we finally made it to the end here.
Oh!
And if you are following us on Twitter, you know that Jake crowdsourced his division pick here, as he just put out a Twitter poll. Who's going to win the AL Central? I can't decide. Let's check in on the results of that poll. I will pull that up quickly.
I have it in front of me.
I am picking the Guardians. Jake,
give me the order.
It is time to decide.
Give me your order.
I'm going Cleveland, Detroit, Minnesota, Kansas City, and your Chicago White Sox over 53.5. Jake, give it to me.
So Twitter says 34% Gardos.
Okay.
But I'm going to zag.
All right.
I'm going to swerve in the corner. Okay. I'm going Tigers.
Okay.
I'm going Guards.
All right.
Twins.
All right.
White Sox, Royals. Okay. Just kidding. Royals, White Sox.
Okay.
I'm going to pick the Tigers.
Okay. That's fine.
And the reason for that was, like, listening to the two of us talk about the Guardians. I think the Guardians got a little too cute with their roster construction this winter.
Possible.
I think
super in play.
I think that I understand why they traded away Jimenez because he's not worth what he's making. I understand why they traded away Naylor. He's going to hit free agency. That's just what they do. I just don't think they got better enough to justify those moves.
Yep.
And this happens to them sometimes.
Yeah.
It happens to Tampa sometimes.
Yeah.
It happens to Milwaukee sometimes. These teams with a track record of sustainability, some years, get too cute, and their team is just simply not good enough.
Yeah.
And if there's an injury to Kwan or Ramirez or Clase, that's could be devastating. And so I am I want the Guardians to be punished for their...
For their finagling?
For their, for being too cutesy and for not putting the pedal down. Because that's the other thing, dude. Look at this team.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is
Let me just say, you watched them, you watched them in the playoffs, right? And even though it was an impressive showing at points, it didn't feel like they were ever going to win the World Series.
Yeah.
No way. Not with this lineup.
Yep.
And it's worse
now. No, and listen, watching it up close, and you know, it's an extreme example when you put them up against the Yankees. But it was laughable. I mean, it's just realistic. And I felt the same way when it would have been the same if the Tigers made it, right? We would have been like, oh, my God, like, really? These are the teams going up against each other? So, you know, that is also a commentary on, you know, disparity in baseball and all these things. But, yeah, we are talking about a team with the 25th largest payroll, which is almost tied with Tampa Bay.
And that's what's frustrating.
And but it's another one where it's like they have more in place and they have proven more that if you give this team – more resources, what could they accomplish? But this is how they operate, for better or for worse. Likely for worse, if you're a Guards fan.
What do you mean, for better, for worse? For worse.
For worse.
This team is frugal as all hell, but it could be for better. It's better for the ownership group, and that's it. Cleveland frustrates me. I know they frustrate the fan base. This organization, the people in this front office, are so good at what they do.
Yeah,
they are so skilled, and they have proven it year after year after year. And if you just gave this front office another $35 million of budget a year, I think they would just win the division all the time. It'd be a little boring.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But like, oh, God.
No, I know. That's, it's all valid. And I'm just...
This should have been Pete. Like, Pete should be on this team.
Oh, man. Right?
You know, like...
Yeah. No, there's... They are the teams like that where it's just like, just go get the one. It's not even...
Teoscar.
We don't have a conversation. Right.
Teoscar. Michael Conforto, even.
Teoscar was... That was one that I think Guardians fans were even like starting to maybe talk themselves into. It's like, no, it's just not how it works. So, frustrating for sure. Are they still good enough to win it? Probably.
Yeah.
But we are going to find out. Jake is taking the Tigers. That is the American League Central. We have one division remaining. It is the AL West. We will talk about Patrick Corbin and the Rangers on Friday. Thank you all for listening. Thank you to Colin and Carter helping produce this episode in studio. We appreciate it. And everyone else here at the Yahoo Studios for making this show possible. We will be back on Friday with the American League West. You can email us baseballbarbacast@gmail.com.
Got some good emails, by the way. On the last episode, we asked you folks, should Jake and Jordan fight more for the views? And we got a resounding yes. So, Jordan, you and your tiny little pea brain, I'm going to move your mic.
No.
Get out of here.
No.
You're done. Thank you all for listening.
The feedback was actually, you guys sound like you're having a good time. So keep agreeing.
Okay.
Thank you all for listening. We'll talk to you on Friday. Bye.